From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a weekend review looking at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
a challenge to the Affordable Care Act could impact thousands of Arkansans.
The numbers in state prisons are projected to grow.
Meanwhile, some inmates convicted of crimes as juveniles could get new sentences.
Getting mental health help for inmates while addressing sexual assault behind bars.
A scare at the Little Rock Air Force Base.
And we look back 70 years after a key decision for civil rights in Little Rock.
That's all coming up from KUAR News. Thanks for joining us for this week's program. And Jacob, we'll start with you. This coming week, we could get a major decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, long awaited, concerning the Affordable Care Act, and in particular, subsidies that go to many states. What are we expecting?
Well, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've been looking at this for some time, and it seems like maybe the last or one of the last lawsuits we'll see of the Obama presidency trying to strike down his signature health care law. And out of this 1,000-plus page bill, there's just one line in it that's in question, that's been called into question by opponents of the Affordable Care Act. It basically says, in order to get those federal subsidies that are supposed to make your insurance plans affordable, if you make too much money to be eligible for Medicaid, it would have to go through what's called a state-based exchange or state-based marketplace. But so far, 34 states rely on the federal government for their exchange, and that's something like healthcare.gov, and we've heard a lot about that. And basically, it means to get your insurance, you go through something the federal government set up, and then based on your income, they'll give you a few hundred dollars to help offset the cost of your premiums.
And that's what Arkansas ended up using because lawmakers didn't want to set up a state exchange here.
Right. And there's all sorts of reasons why you don't want to, why Arkansas chose that back when they approved everything initially. But back in 2013, they did say, Arkansas, we need to move towards implementing a state-based exchange. So we have had a health insurance marketplace board that's been set up the past several years that has been moving forward, and they've been planning since before this case to, in 2017, launch the state-based exchange. And their argument is, we've learned a lot from other states in that time. It'll give Arkansas more local control. A lot of Republicans obviously don't like the idea of a federal program if you could be done on the state level. And Health Insurance Marketplace Board Director Cheryl Smith Gardner, she's Cheryl Smith back in May, but had since got married. She commented a little bit right after Arkansas received the federal grant money that it will use for the 2017 launch.
The problem is most of the states have not yet applied for any kind of funding to build their exchanges. So that was the other reason the board thought it was very important that we go ahead and get this funding in place. In the event something like that happens and we need to convert, we have now not only the ability, but we have the funding to do that, to establish our own state-based marketplace.
And so what we heard from Cheryl Gardner is that Arkansas has the money to implement this marketplace. We're going to launch in 2017, and we're going to launch a smaller version for just businesses in 2016. So the question is, if the Supreme Court decides you can only get subsidies for those 70,000 Arkansans or so through a state-based exchange, Arkansas can't turn the switch overnight and turn this on, but maybe there would be some sort of rushed implementation we could have. And Senator Hendren told Talk Business and Politics, the Senate Majority Leader, that he thinks a special session would be necessary to figure out what to do with those 70,000 people who lose $200 or $300 for their premiums. But the governor's office has said, no, at this time we don't have any plans for a special session. But regardless, with all this planning going on, with the federal money already achieved, the legislature still has to vote at some point whether to say, now that we have it already, we're going to do it.
Well, we'll see what happens from the U.S. Supreme Court. We had several prison-related stories this week by chance. And Sarah, one of those involves a hearing on Wednesday. And Arkansas's prison population is still rising at a rapid pace compared to other states around the country, despite efforts to ease overcrowding. First, tell me a little about this report that was presented to officials during a legislative hearing that you were at.
A researcher from JFA Associates, that's a nonprofit research institute that assesses correction systems around the country, Wendy Ware spoke with lawmakers and correction officials about projected growth rates over the next decade in the criminal justice system in Arkansas. And although there's been a lot of discussion in the last legislative session, last few months, about early release of prisoners and dealing with some of the issues of overcrowding, state prisons backing into county jail numbers, and those county jails have been delayed in getting paid. And, you know, it's been an ongoing crisis in the state. As it turns out, the things aren't looking very good going forward either. This year, the prison population is at about 18,000, and she projects that by the year 2025, it'll be at almost 26,000.
In 2013, you saw an increase of 2,600 people in a 12-month time period, okay? By percentages, you were the fastest growing prison population in the United States in 2013, growing at a rate over seven times the national average.
So to give a little of the back history, up until about 2010, the state was growing, its population rate was growing pretty steadily, and some national reform efforts influenced lawmakers in the state, and they decided to pass a law to reduce requirements for felonies and drug-related offenses to reduce the prison population. Then the following year, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette published a series of stories about Darrell Dennis, the eight-time parole absconder who was recently convicted for murdering an 18-year-old in northwest Arkansas. And this led to outrage. The Board of Corrections decided to adjust rules about parolees and probationers and tracking how they're actually meeting the terms of their probation. And it led to this huge overcrowding crisis she's talking about in 2013, where Arkansas suddenly became the state with the highest prison overcrowding rate in the country, the fastest increasing rate in the country. So since then, the state has continued to grow steadily at slower rates and is on the course still, mostly because of parole violators and the frequency which with they're being brought back into the system, to top national numbers.
You are still over what you saw for the previous 10-year period. So if we just look at the average from 2000 to 2010, that's about 3%. And last year, you grew by 3.7%. Okay? So you're still growing faster than you ever have.
But there were efforts, despite the laws passed in 2013, there were efforts to try to take steps to reduce the prison population.
The Arkansas Department of Community Corrections has been working with community groups to create the avenues for prisoners to leave early with educational programs, like the Arkansas Baptist College has a accredited college program they're launching for inmates to learn entrepreneurial skills. The department has contracts that they're seeking vendors, both church groups and community groups, who will create reentry programs where prisoners can be housed in separate facilities. And recently this week, they approved a strategy for the upcoming year to seek more volunteers as part of their program to help bring people back into society and make their reentry successful so they don't increase those recidivism rates and go end up back in jail. Because as it was, they were being sent out of prison with, you know, a small amount of money and a bus ticket and not much of a prospect for getting a job or being able to make a life for themselves. So that has been a big priority this most recent legislative session. And then, of course, the governor approved funding and the legislature passed funding for more prison space. I think that this report draws attention to some of the real bigger picture issues that haven't really gone away despite those efforts.
And Sarah, do you have any idea how receptive lawmakers in that committee were to this report? Because I imagine there's some, the same people that after the Darrell Dennis case, who is an individual who's from Little Rock who's murdered, I imagine a lot of them might think that previous lower number was maybe a false normal because of bad probation practices. And I bet there's got to be some that think that this new number, even though it's higher, is more of what that natural number needs to be for them to base things off of.
Well, Jacob, the Task Force on Criminal Justice Oversight is largely made up of correction officials and lawmakers. And there weren't any vocal critics that really spoke out against the message of the report. And I think that might have to do with the fact that it wasn't a full legislative committee. It's a task force of experts and relevant institutions.
But expecting a population to reach more than 25,000 by 2025 is pretty striking. Well, on the topic of criminal justice, an opinion was issued this week by the Arkansas Supreme Court that may clear the way for more than 50 state inmates to get new sentences. And Chris, this had to do with a U.S. Supreme Court decision on mandatory life sentences for juveniles. And then the state Supreme Court now weighing in on a case here.
Yeah, and many observers say it sets a precedent for some estimates about 55 state inmates who received mandatory life sentences as juveniles for capital cases, including capital murder. In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the Miller versus Alabama case that mandatory life sentences for juveniles without the possibility of parole is a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and is cruel and unusual punishment. There was a companion case to that Miller versus Alabama, Jackson versus Hobbs, and that has an Arkansas connection. Contrell Jackson was a 14-year-old in eastern Arkansas and was involved in a convenience store shooting at the age of 14. And he was sentenced to life in prison for capital murder without parole. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that his case should get a resentencing due to the fact that it was, they considered, cruel and unusual punishment to sentence him to a mandatory life sentence. Now, in light of that, there have been some further challenges to sentences in other states for juveniles who are convicted of murder. In this case, Alonzo Gordon versus the state. Alonzo Gordon was convicted of capital murder in Crittenden County for a crime that he committed at the age of 17. And his attorneys sought a writ of habeas corpus to basically find that his sentence was unjust, unfair, in light of this Supreme Court case. The county court or county circuit court in eastern Arkansas found that it was unfair, and they said that he could receive a resentencing hearing. The state appealed that, and therefore we have this Arkansas Supreme Court opinion written by Associate Justice Robin Wynn. Observers say, including Alonzo Gordon's attorney Jeff Rosenzweig, say it sets a precedent for other inmates who are convicted as juveniles the same way. Here he is commenting on a couple of significant points.
Here, the Arkansas Supreme Court has reiterated that it's a matter of fundamental fairness to treat people equally who are similarly situated. That's number one. Number two is you have people who, by definition, made bad mistakes or judgments when they were teenagers, and there's been a lot more understanding about the teenage mind since most of these people went to prison. That's the basis for the Miller-Jackson ruling, that you've got to give these people, you can't just mandatorily say, lock them up and throw away the key forever and ever. You just can't do it.
So, Chris, what will happen next on this issue and for these 50-some-odd inmates?
Well, the Attorney General's office could challenge this opinion, and we could see what happens from there. But if the opinion stands, there are basically two steps for the inmates who remain. Number one, they would each attempt to pursue a writ of habeas corpus in circuit courts where they're incarcerated to determine whether their sentence was unfair. If the court grants that writ of habeas corpus, then the inmates would have to pursue resentencing hearings in the jurisdiction of their original crime. And if that's the case, it's likely that many of them will receive public defenders. And here I spoke with Greg Parrish, the executive director of the Arkansas Public Defenders Commission. Here he's commenting on what it might take to relitigate these cases and the resources it will involve.
Since it's a capital case, from our standpoint, we will start all over. We will have to address all the factors that are required for sentencing, which includes mitigation. And that means acquiring records, family interviews from birth till the present time. you know, there are some inmates that were sentenced many years ago. And there's been a lot of developments with technology since then. We will appoint at least one attorney on each case. We will appoint an investigator, and we will appoint a mitigation specialist. All of those things are required by law that we do, and it becomes our obligation to make sure that that is satisfied.
Now, Parrish points out that they likely don't have the resources to relitigate all these cases. There was an appropriation of $2.5 million from the Beebe administration after that U.S. Supreme Court case in anticipation of something like this. But Parrish says they'll probably need more than that, and they'll have to ask the legislature for more money. And it's important to note that, and this was pointed out in the Arkansas Supreme Court opinion, that the original convictions will stand, and probably in most of these cases, and it did in the case of Alonzo Gordon, because they received fair trials. But the resentencing is almost like a trial in itself.
Right, where new evidence can be considered, and often attorneys have to dig back into dusty old folders and look back at the circumstances and try to present a case to for defense attorneys to get leniency.
Yeah, and I should also point out that there's the possibility that they could receive life sentences without parole again. I mean, there's nothing in state statute that forbids that sentence. It's just no longer mandatory for capital offenses for juvenile cases.
And it does seem like there has been a trend in recent years for courts not to treat juveniles as harshly and to sometimes give more benefit of a doubt for crimes committed by juveniles.
And Chris, I was wondering a little bit too about, you said the legislature would have to probably appropriate some more money for these, the kind of defense that these people have in mind. So what would happen, do you know, into these cases if that money wasn't appropriated? So I believe Representative Greg Letting of Fayetteville had some bill last time around that didn't get too far that would try to end life sentences for juveniles, for instance, and that didn't get enough support.
Yeah, right. It got voted down in the House. Well, one thing that Parrish pointed out was that in preparing for these cases, they've been following a lot of the 50-odd cases, and they've already absorbed a lot of the costs of doing that in their regular budget. And it's likely that, you know, if that money weren't available, that they'd simply have to find a way to absorb it in their regular budget, which is about $24 million, you said. Now, that would stretch them pretty thin, of course, but, you know, they're, like you said, required by law to litigate cases in which their clients are indigent or basically lacking in all assets. And you know, a lot of these inmates have been in prison for quite a while. It's likely that they don't have any form of sustainable income. They might have family members who could pay, but a majority of the cases will probably go to public defenders.
Well, another issue for inmates in prison is often mental illness. And on Thursday, there was research presented to state lawmakers that's part of an effort by the Arkansas Public Policy Panel, which is advocating for the creation of mental illness crisis centers for the criminal justice system in the state. Sarah, you were at that hearing, and the proponents of this say this could actually save the state a lot of money.
That's right. Advocates for mental health crisis centers told lawmakers that states like Oklahoma, New Mexico, Oregon, and various others have piloted programs where they create crisis centers and they have trained staff to redirect some of the low-level mentally ill inmates. And that allows law enforcement officials to focus on criminals in the system and allows mentally ill people to get the treatment they need to be able to return to their family. So economist Jim Metzger, who is a consultant for the Arkansas Public Policy Panel, described the research he's done about how Arkansas could create a plan that would save the state, he says, $140 million a year by creating such a crisis center.
The crisis center approach is going to have the kind of people involved who are better prepared to help mentally ill persons. even if they're arrested for offenses, I'm assuming here we're talking mostly about nonviolent offenses, but those kind of folks are going to be better treated with evaluation, crisis services, dedicated community treatment, case management, care coordination, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the sorts of things we can't expect from our prison facilities. That's not what they're in the business of doing. So they're not going to treat mentally ill people with the kind of care that they need. I'm not saying that they would abuse them necessarily. That's not my point. The point is that they are not professionally trained and available to do what is needed here. Secondly, the removal of this higher cost group of imprisoned persons in Arkansas from the prison system. So if we can move a low-risk group of mentally ill people out of that high-cost environment, allows law enforcement to concentrate their limited resources on the higher-risk criminals and people who have been adjudicated for incarceration, and allows them to spend their time and energies there and spend our tax dollars there better than on low-risk mentally ill persons.
So the report found that there are roughly 3,500 mentally ill inmates currently housed in jails and prisons in the state, and that it costs about 20 times more to house them in jail than it would to treat their mental illness. What remains unanswered is how much these crisis centers would cost the state. So this is a sort of early level proposal.
And other states have implemented similar programs. What kind of results have been seen elsewhere?
This $140 million saving figure is something that the report drew from the success of other states. So they have seen this type of success.
And one final prison-related item. There is also an effort to address sexual assaults in prisons.
About a month ago, Governor Asa Hutchinson responded to a Department of Justice request that went out to all state governors to communicate whether the state was complying with the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And Governor Asa Hutchinson, along with the governors of four other states, responded that he wouldn't indicate whether he was in compliance or working on being in compliance. Since then, the Department of Justice has launched an investigation into a women's prison, the McPherson unit near Newport, which houses around 800 prisoners, because allegations have come to light that staff members may have engaged in sexual intercourse with prisoners, and they may have watched prisoners while they showered and mistreated female transgender prisoners in the facility. So a national survey done by the government, 10% of respondents at this particular unit in recent years said that they had experienced some kind of sexual violation. Arkansas, according to Bureau of Justice Statistics, is twice as likely as other states for inmates to be victims of instances of sexual abuse and harassment that are substantiated. And, you know, it's possible that one of the reasons that the state isn't inclined to comply with this act, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, is that it has various stipulations that are somewhat inconvenient. It requires an audit the state has to pay for. It bans cross-gendered guards of a different gender from inmates from coming up unannounced to check on them or investigate what they're doing, and also requires transgendered inmates to be housed based on health and safety, not based on their birth gender. So these are problems or complications that the state evidently doesn't want to deal with, although the Department of Justice is obviously finding another way to address what seem to be some serious issues going on in the prisons here.
Okay. Well, another item this week, we had quite a bit of a scare at the Little Rock Air Force Base, though there was certainly a very serious incident, Jacob, where someone pulled a truck up over a curb at the main gate going into it, pulled a gun, and was shot by guards there at the gate. And the initial fear was maybe this was something bigger than a deranged person. Maybe this was some kind of terrorist attack or something more. Tell me a little about what happened here.
Yeah, and I think that is what everyone was immediately concerned about. Shooting anywhere is automatically raises alarm bells and makes people worried. But the larger connection, especially because it was at a military base, Arkansas in recent memory had a deadly shooting at an Army recruiting station where a local man had become a convert to radical Islam. We've saw in several other Army base shootings like in Fort Hood in Texas, where is a military member. But this appears to be just a local man from Jacksonville who lived near the airbase who clearly had mental health problems and drug issues. He, for instance, believed that the military, including deceased Confederate generals and fictional people, were spying on him in his house. And his dad really, he commented a little bit to a local TV reporter, and it sounded like he thought this was a cry for help or a suicide attempt more than anything else. But let's listen to Sergeant Jason Armstrong, who's with the base's public affairs office. I talked to him Monday morning before they revealed the identity of the shooter, Larry McElroy.
We had a male suspect approach the gate to gain unauthorized access to the base. He did not make it to the gate. From what I understand, he ran into a light pole, which pretty much brought the vehicle to a stop. He exited his vehicle, showed that he had a weapon. And our security forces airmen, who are on duty, as they usually are, working their security measures at the front gate, they went ahead and eliminated him from taking any further action. He was shot.
Right, and officials then took him to a local area hospital where he remained in critical condition for a few days. He has since passed away, and no one was injured at the time. The man never made it into the Air Force base. He was stopped just outside of the Air Force main gate. If we have any more developments in terms of his ideology, what he was thinking about, or if this was a planned thing or just something he randomly did, that'll come out from the FBI. But of course, towards the end of the week, we had another major shooting in South Carolina. And the difference is they're both lone gunman type characters. But the difference here seems to be the man in Jacksonville didn't belong to any larger narrative going on in the country about white supremacy or radical Islam or anything like that.
And we knew still never really heard anything about motivation other than a paranoia.
Yeah, he believed the Air Force base and the military was spying on him in some way. So that seems to be part of it. And if his dad's point is correct, that it was some sort of death wish, then he knew surely he was in Jacksonville, that a close place to do that and a place that would have happened would be the Air Force base.
Well, with that, we'll wrap up our roundtable discussion here. And thanks for joining me, Jacob Kaufman, Sarah White-Skotacek, and Chris Hickey.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
And Chris, before we go, we're going to close out with a piece that you produced for us, looking at an anniversary 70 years ago today as we record this on Friday. Before we get to your piece, tell me a little about this and what we're going to be hearing.
Yeah, a federal appeals court in St. Louis issued a ruling that African-American teachers in Little Rock School District should receive pay equal to their white counterparts. And here's the story of that case, as well as how it affected black activism in Little Rock.
All right, let's hear it.
In 1943, the Little Rock Classroom Teachers Association, with the help of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and attorney Thurgood Marshall, brought a class action lawsuit against the school district on behalf of 86 black teachers. The case was filed in the courtroom of District Judge Thomas C. Trimble. The CTA had recently formed a salary adjustment committee. They found on average black elementary school teachers received average annual salaries of $331 compared to $526 earned by white teachers. Black high school teachers earned average salaries of $567 compared to $856 earned by whites.
We felt that our teachers and principal deserved equal pay because they had equal credentials to the white teachers and principals. In fact, sometimes our people had more advanced degrees and more experience and still made lower salaries.
Faustine Jones Wilson attended Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School at the time of the trial and graduated in 1945. While a student, she says the grown-ups often did not discuss the lawsuit with the younger generation, but she and her peers understood that inequities persisted throughout the education system.
We got the hand-me-down books from the white school. Now, we did resent that. I remember that so clearly. Why should we get the hand-me-down books when our parents and adults pay taxes just like everybody else.
University of Arkansas at Little Rock professor and Arkansas civil rights historian John Kirk says the case for equal pay followed several other similar suits filed by the NAACP around the country, intending to chip away at the notion of separate but equal.
What's specific about the Little Rock case and what makes it interesting and important in terms of the NAACP's wider campaign is that in Little Rock, they introduced a so-called merit rating sheet.
Kirk says the school district used the long list of criteria on the rating sheet as a means to determine salaries.
And it just so happens that African-American teachers turn out on this independent criteria to be worse than white teachers.
In order to prove the teacher rating system was discriminatory, Marshall and the other attorneys chose as their lead plaintiff the chair of the English department at Dunbar High School, 31-year-old Sue Cowan Morris.
Basically, my credentials, everything I had done was from an accredited school.
In a 1993 interview conducted by Kirk a year before her death, Morris described her experience at some of the top higher ed institutions open to her as a student. She had completed academic programs at Talladega College in Alabama, Spelman College in Atlanta, and a graduate program in English instruction at the University of Chicago. With credentials exceeding those of many white teachers, along with her respected approach in the classroom, the legal team considered Morris the best candidate to prove there was discrimination.
I didn't think we'd win right off, but eventually I thought maybe we'd win. And as some people decided that I would be the test case, that I knew that I was going to get back.
Morris and the other black teachers did not initially win their case in Judge Trimble's court, and the Little Rock School District did not renew Morris's contract the following year. Neither did they renew contracts for John Lewis, the principal of Dunbar High, or Dunbar teacher and head of the Classroom Teachers Association, John Gibson. But a couple years later, on June 19, 1945, the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Judge Trimble's ruling, clearing the way for pay equity in the LRSD. Despite this, Sue Cowan Morris did not immediately regain employment in the district. She did stints at Arkansas AM&N College in Pine Bluff, a Jacksonville munitions factory, and later at Arkansas Baptist College. Morris eventually returned to her old school after Dunbar's new principal, Leroy Christoph, petitioned the school district for her reinstatement. She recalled a conversation with then-superintendent Harry Little about her rehiring.
I know he called me and said, "Have you learned your lesson?" And Mr. Christoph was very upset over that question. He said he didn't know how I was going to answer. And I said, yes.
Morris, who remarried later in life and became Sue Cowan Williams, said she hated to tell the superintendent she was sorry, but the case did leave lasting impressions on the African-American community.
I think it's important to realize that during that time, and certainly prior to the Little Rock Central High School incident, outward activism was just something that was not even in the minds of people.
Treopia Washington's mother, Lothair Green, and aunt, Treopia Scott, were teachers involved in the class action suit. Washington says her family called them the Steel Magnolias for their quiet resilience. Even though the more outspoken civil rights activism of the 1960s was a long way off, Washington says the case required a bravery which eventually extended down a generation to her younger brother, Ernest Green, one of nine black students to integrate Central High School in 1957. Historian John Kirk says the case also catalyzed the NAACP's work in the state, which before had little influence in Arkansas. It was a result of strained relations between the local community and the national office.
But the teacher's salary suit really changed that. It got Thurgood Marshall into the city. It got the NAACP connected to local people here in Little Rock. And very soon after, an Arkansas State Conference of Branches was founded in 1945.
10 years later, Marshall and the NAACP would go on to win the Supreme Court case Brown versus Board of Education. Treopia Washington credits teacher salary suits as contributing a step in that direction.
The more I think about it, I think people like my mother and aunt and the other teachers who were involved in that really, really were the heroes, heroines of society.
Today, a public library adjacent to the former Dunbar High School, now a junior high, bears Sue Cowan Williams' name. Chris Hickey, KUAR News.
And with that, we're done. You've been listening to KUAR's Week in Review, produced by me, Michael Heblin, joined by reporters and anchors Jacob Kaufman, Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, and Chris Hickey. We're now included on iTunes, so you can find the podcast there. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, we hope you'll subscribe so that you can hear us each week. We welcome your feedback. Send any comments, ideas, corrections, or concerns to news@kuar.org. KUAR is an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, funded in large part through your donations. Our theme music is by our own Chris Hickey. Until next time, thanks for listening.